Session number 10814, room 3.
The job of the boats, one of the jobs rather, it was to go across to the enemy coast because at that time the army had only got up as far as the Belgian-Dutch border and were finding it difficult to go further north at that particular time. So our job really was to go across and listen, stop, cut engines and listen. And we had most extraordinary piece of equipment. It makes one laugh today to think about it. We used to hang over the side an instrument on the end of a pole. There was an A bracket that one fixed to the side of the ship. One lowered down this ASDIC instrument and swung this through various arcs to try and detect what in fact was approaching. When one thinks of that today, all that is built in to the ships, it makes it appear ludicrously antediluvian. But it was an instrument that we used, and it was an instrument in fact that was very valuable. Very sick making, I can assure you, sitting on the side and trying to listen to the various noises that were in the area, ships that one could detect a mile or two away with their engine noise. And if one thought it was an enemy, we'd just have to take this bloody thing back and put it, stow it on board, steam off in that direction and investigate and find that it was a ship, you know, carrying butter or a small e-boat or whatever. The other thing that I recall now, of course, is that Lightning was one of the earlier ships to have radar. The radar in those days, remember this was 1941, was a fixed aerial onto the top of the mast. You can see it there in the picture, in point of fact.
Yes.
And in order, and this had an arc of about 45 degrees, if I remember correctly, and we could only see on the screen anything within that arc. So if we wanted to see something that was approaching from astern, the boat had to be turned through 180 degrees. It makes one smile today to think, you know, that practically every small yacht of any size now has a radar, and the radar thing goes round and round, and you don't have to point the ship in the direction to which you think something might be approaching. But an invaluable piece of equipment, of course. But how ancient, you know, when we think about it all today. Fascinating, really. We then came back to, as I say, we were based then in Great Yarmouth. VE Day was celebrated, as you can imagine, with great jubilation. That afternoon, we, our flotilla, had a signal to proceed north to Lerwick, to then join with a Norwegian flotilla, split into three groups, and go straight into Norway. So we set out from Great Yarmouth. The first place we stopped at to refuel was Immingham, and then we went to Aberdeen, and from Aberdeen up to Lerwick. And there we joined up with the Norwegian flotilla and split into three groups. The first group went to Bergen, the other went to Stavanger, and we went furthest north to a place called Alsund. And, went there. We had a Norwegian pilot on board. We carried drums of fuel on the after deck because it was quite a long way, and we weren't absolutely certain that we were going to get fuel when we got to the other end, of course. We went into one of the fjords, and I can remember quite clearly going through this fjord, and there, either side, up on the hills either side, we could see the German guns pointing in our direction. This was only 2 days after, was it, or three? 3 days after VE Day. The Germans, in fact, had not surrendered. We knew this, and we could have been blown out of the water, I suppose, although, you know, we thought it unlikely, and thank God it didn't happen. Why were we going to Norway? We were going to Norway to show the flag, I suppose, certainly, together with the Norwegians, and give them joys and happiness with their compatriots as well, but also to assess the strength of the German units that were there in these various places. Now, we knew that there were going to be German units there. Nothing of any great consequence, as it turned out. A few armed trawlers, couple of corvettes, and a few E-boats were there. Well, nothing happened, thank God, so far as the enemy were concerned. The jubilation and the pleasure that we experienced, of course, from the Norwegians was quite outstanding. Civic reception, a dinner in the town hall, wonderful food, great company, and altogether most memorable experience. We spent a few days there, about 3 or 4 days there. Then we went up a little further north to a place called Molde, which was a German midget submarine base. And there we discovered a number of midget submarines, some in commission, some partially completed, and some still in their packing cases. Because what had happened, the Germans transported those to this base, and it was a sort of, you know, in kit form, if you like, and they were assembled there on the spot and commissioned there on the spot. We all know our geography reasonably well, and that was almost on the same latitude, you see, as the north, as the Shetlands and Orkneys, which was the route, of course, of some of the convoys coming in and going out from the east coast. So they were in a strategic position. I've never seen anything quite like it. If you look under the bonnet of a well-made motor car today, I won't necessarily say a German motor car, when it's brand spanking new and you see how well it's been put together and all the shining pieces of equipment, that is precisely what these things look like. I give great credit and top marks to the German engineers and designers who design something as beautiful as that. Evil though their intent obviously was. Anyway, we were there and we reported back what we found out, and that was all we had to do, really, to find out what was there. The people in Bergen did the same, and the people in Stavanger did the same. What they found, well, we heard to some extent. Then we came back to Lerwick and
what was the demeanour of the German personnel in Norway?
Surly, without any doubt. You know, we haven't lost the war. What the hell are you doing here? Many of them, I think, were, yes, I think the word would be surly. Uncooperative. Bolshe, you know, those sort of words, really, were the kind of people. But they weren't all like that. Some were quite cooperative. They knew why we were there. They knew that they could have blown us out of the water if they wanted to, but after all, the war was over, so what the hell were they going to gain as a result of that? A few more English lives, perhaps, but I think if we'd been in the same situation, I think we'd have reacted in much the same kind of way. The reception, as I say, by the Norwegians was fantastic, and the photographs I've given to your colleague, I think, amply illustrate the happy time that we had there.
Just going back to the earlier period when you were taking part in these aggressive actions off the enemy North Sea coast,
yes,
in the early part of 1945,
yes,
if you had met E-boats then, how would a British motor torpedo boat have fared against an E-boat at that time?
The E-boats, it's interesting. It's an interesting question. The E-boats were round bilge, like the MLs, but they had more powerful engines. They were as fast, they were faster than our D-type MTBs. They had not much, but slightly. They had less firepower than we had. So, in an endeavour to answer your question, I think it would have depended really on how we met them, or you know, the circumstances, really. We had, as I say, less speed, more firepower. So if we met them suddenly and our gunners were really on the job, we would have knocked hell out of them. On the other hand, if we'd only winged them, they would stood a chance of getting away. I mean, the tactics obviously were to fire as fast as you could, as accurately as you could, and then get the hell out of it, or whatever. I mean, our job obviously was to, as indeed theirs was, to find the right sort of target and torpedo the ship. But to get in the right position, not all that easy, really. I hope that's answered the question reasonably well.
From the kind of speed and armament which you described for an MTB, it must have been a really deadly weapon, even against much bigger enemy warships, if you'd come across them.
Yes, well, to some extent, yes. I suppose the largest really would have been a corvette or a destroyer. But don't forget, they would have much heavier firepower and, of course, greater armour as well, so that whilst our guns, certainly if directed at the right, I mean at the bridge, for example, would have done a lot of damage, but you've got to know where to fire and how to fire and get away pretty quickly, because 1 4-inch shell on one of our little wooden cockle shells, I mean that's curtains, absolutely. Whereas one shell from our main armament, if you like, would have not done a great deal of damage unless it had been in the right situation. One thinks immediately of HMS Hood. One particular shell in one particular place. End of the Hood.
But I was thinking of your torpedoes
I thought you were talking about guns rather than torpedoes. Oh, I mean a torpedo in the right place, and that's oh, one of our torpedoes at a capital ship, of course, would have like the U-boat with the Ark Royal. The Ark Royal certainly had some armour, below water armour, but not enough, of course, to prevent it from being torpedoed by an equivalent torpedo to those that we carried. I don't think the German torpedoes were any larger, but just one got home. We had four, so you would fan them out. But there again, ships take evasive action. For example, I see this capital ship or destroyer, whatever, coming along at right angle, shall we say. The moment they would pick us up with their radar or detect us in any way, the first thing they do is to alter course straight for us, so as to minimise the fanning of the torpedoes. And in many instances, of course, you know, you look down and think, my God, Fathers, there was one 20 feet away, you know. Not a happy thought, but many and oft have been the times when that has prevented ships from being torpedoed.
What was the division of duties between these three or four officers on board the ship?
The captain, obviously, was in total command, and his responsibility was for obeying the instructions of the senior officer, assuming that he was not the senior officer, the instructions of the senior officer. Had he been the senior officer, then his responsibilities would be for controlling the movement and disposition of the ships under his command. He would possibly have three or four other motor torpedoes with him. He would know what his instructions were before leaving base, i.e. to go here or do that or cover this or just to search in that particular area. That, as I said earlier, could well have been controlled by a larger vessel in that particular area and disposition monitored. The first lieutenant's job is really the running of the ship. He is the if you like, the managing director rather than the chairman. His job's made quite certain that everything is functioning properly. His responsibilities are obviously to the captain, but he's the chap that goes down into the engine room and talks to the ERA to make quite sure that everything's all right down there, and it's clean and wholesome as well and well cared for, and that the duties of each and every one of the crew is carried out correctly, to make quite sure that the gunners know what their jobs and their functions are, to make quite sure the guns are clean as well, to look after the livelihood, really, to be a nanny, if you like, to the crew members. The third officer is really the navigating officer. He's the chap who sits down there in the chart room with his various instruments, keeps a plot of where the boat is, where it's got to go, all details, and to keep the charts up to date, obviously, to make quite sure that signals are coming in and sufficiently monitored, and feeds the captain with information. There's the captain up there. He doesn't know whether he's here, there, or anywhere. But the navigating officer's responsibilities are for, you know, making quite certain that, A, we're going in the right direction, and when it's all over and done with, we find our way back to Dover Harbour or wherever it may be. And I can tell you, charging around at sea, even in peacetime, isn't all that, isn't all that easy, unless one has electronic gadgets. And of course today one has one of the most incredible pieces of equipment on board yachts that you can buy for only a few hundred quid today. Give you latitude, longitude, position, course and speed, everything. And of course you have radar. You don't have to point the ship in the direction that you want to look at. You have the radar going around, and the radar today has, some of them have ranges of, on a modest sized yacht, of 20 miles, 25 miles.
In those offensive actions which you took part in off the enemy coast, what degree of success did you have against enemy shipping, do you remember?
Very little, in point of fact. It may sound strange to you, but the number of sorties that we were engaged in produced hardly anything worth recording, in my experience.
Was this because the Germans were on their last legs then?
I think to some extent it could have been. I was in the in motor torpedo boats, as you now know, latterly rather than formerly, and obviously during the run up to D-Day and immediately after D-Day, enemy action was very considerable, and many of the flotillas were involved in some pretty nasty sorties. I suppose one could only say that I was fortunate in being up in Scotland commissioning this boat for that particular time, and then Holyhead, and then coming down, and I think what you say is possibly the reason, really. There really wasn't so much going on at that particular time. Mind you, I saw enough action in the Mediterranean during the landings at Anzio and places like that from the platform of a capital ship, it is true, but nevertheless, it's I suppose that really is the reason.
We haven't said anything about Anzio.
No, we didn't really. No. Well, I think we skipped that rather. The admiral that I was with was on board Nelson for some of the time. He then hoisted his flag in Warspite for a few weeks, and Indomitable and Formidable for a few weeks at a time. In other words, to be around. This was the time of the Sicilian landings and working up the coast. And that was, whilst we were off there, and as I said earlier, bombarding Anzio, bombarding Reggio Calabria, there was a lot going on, and the Germans had some of these radio controlled bombs which were pretty novel at the time, and Warspite was hit on two or three occasions, I remember, limping into Valletta Harbour having controlled the damage and damage control system remarkably well, so that instead of being lopsided or down by the bow or the stern, she was actually floating much lower in the water, but stable. Most incredible feat, I think, really, of any damage control crew, which gives great credit, I think, to those concerned. Several other ships were hit by these confounded things that were dropped by aircraft. You know about them. The Germans had perfected these things, dropped by aircraft, and just floated around and zeroed in on whatever ship happened to be in that particular area. Nasty things. Very nasty.